Sachs. Hey, wait a second. You want to say something? Go up to the microphone.
Good morning, Your Honor. Joshua Sachs. I'm here this morning for two of the defendants, Mr. Gill and Mr. Adams.
Sit down, please.
I will first just take a short moment to address the situation with Mr. Gill. The government and the defense are agreed that there has to be a remand with respect to the sentence, and I would suggest, I found this case last night while I was updating myself, United States versus Barnes, which this, it's 660 Federal 3rd 1000, decided by this court in 2011, and in that case, at page 1007, at the bottom of 1007, the court discusses what the scope of a general resentencing remand is, and it's and I think that this is what the proper result is in this case. Don't send this case back to Judge Kennelly with any specific instructions as to just what the remand scope is, but a general remand for resentencing, as defined by this court in the Barnes case, is the right resolution for Mr. Gill. And I don't think, unless the court has any questions, I don't think there's anything else that it's necessary to say about Mr. Gill.
You're citing a new case that you should submit supplemental briefing, or just a reference to it, so we have.
I will be happy to do
it. It's not in your brief, right?
It's not in the brief, as I say. I just found it last night.
Okay. Well, nobody's seen it for this purpose, so you should at least send it to the court.
I will do that, Your Honor.
To your point.
Is there any disagreement between you and the government with regard to the remand?
I don't think so. That there should be a remand, I believe that.
But I
that
mean, we you're throwing this case out now as if it's something that.
The reason I suggested it is the government, in its brief at page 47, cites the Palladino case from this court to say a limited remand is appropriate to determine whether the district court wishes to resentence Gill in light of Pew. I don't know whether there's really a disagreement or not, but I think that...
Well, that's quite different, though, from order. I thought your point, that's different from ordering resentencing, right? The Palladino remand asked the judge to tell us, do you want us to remand for resentencing, or no, because I'd give the same sentence.
Well,
I take it you want the order to resentence rather than just the Palladino remand.
I think that if we order a resentencing and the judge looks at it and says, well, I'd do the same thing, he can certainly do that under a Barnes remand as well as under a Palladino remand.
Now, you're missing my point.
Sorry, Your Honor.
You want us to order the resentencing, don't you?
Yes.
You're not content with the Palladino remand.
I am asking for a Barnes
right,
remand.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you. Any other questions regarding Gill?
But then,
no.
Is that,
oh, sorry.
What I was going to say, is that your understanding of what the government agrees to? Well, we can ask them when they come up.
I think the government is asking for a Palladino remand, Your Honor.
So you want the resentence?
Yes, I do.
Okay, that's fine.
As far as the Adams case, if I can make an analogy as to what's going on here, when you have a franchise business that puts restaurants or ice cream shops or whatever in various areas, typically there's an agreement that you won't put your franchises right on top of each other, because although you're all part of the same franchise, as between the franchisees, you are competitors. That's what happened with Mr. Adams. He is one of a number of people who's selling drugs for Mr. Bagley, but he's an independent contractor. He's got his only relationship is directly Adams to Fagley.
And he's got a corner, and he has hours from 6 to noon.
That's right, Your Honor.
Well, somebody's telling him that's where you sell, and here's all the time you got.
Mr. Bagley's telling him that. And
well,
Mr. Bagley is putting his competing franchisees, he's putting three or four of them right on the same block at the same time.
They all know each other there, right, too?
Oh, there's no question they
and
know
they
each
know
other
they're
there.
Taking orders from Bagley.
Pardon me?
They all know that they're taking orders from Bagley. Right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And as each of them has a relationship with Bagley, each of them is in a conspiracy with Bagley, as between them individually, they are competing franchisees, and that's why Mr. Adams is responsible for what he's selling with Mr. Bagley. He's not responsible for what the other three or four guys on the block are selling for Mr. Bagley.
At different times.
Same time.
They all have a noon, 6 to noon?
That's my understanding, Your Honor, that there would be three or four guys working that block at the same time.
And then they're relieved. They have something displaced, I guess, from 12 to 6 and then 6 to next morning or something. Right? I assume these guys operate in shifts.
There may be different shifts, but each, as I understand what is described here, in each shift, and what Mr. Adams was held responsible for, in each shift, there might be three or four fellows working this one block for Mr. Bagley, each of them an independent contractor with Mr. Bagley. Mr. Bagley's got them right on top of each other. I don't think anybody is saying that Mr. Adams is responsible for what people on some other shift are doing. The government is saying he's responsible for what everybody on his shift is doing, and what we're saying is each of those people on the shift is an independent contractor. Mr. Bagley stuffed them right in on top of each other, but they're not not working together. They're working against each other. If there are any other questions... otherwise, I'll yield my time to co-counsel.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sachs.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Schiller?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Brendan Schiller. I represent Christopher Hunter. I think I got really two succinct points here. One is that Mr. Hunter clearly evinced an intention to preserve this issue for appeal. And if I failed to do it properly, then I was probably objectively deficient. And I think those are my only two points given the response.
Was your problem that they didn't, that the government and the judge didn't go along?
I mean, we put it in the plea declaration, obviously. I don't know, frankly, if the judge would have went along. I don't think the government was going to go along.
No, but isn't that what they have to do if you're going to reserve something for appeal?
I think it is, but I think the fact that I didn't take all the necessary proper steps, and we don't know as part of the record whether or not it would have been preserved, is why my actions were objectively deficient. I don't think we know as a record whether or not. Obviously, that's a different question, whether or not the government, if the government and judge would have rejected it, it would have been preserved. But if I had taken all the proper steps, then my client would have had the opportunity to just go to trial just to preserve this singular issue for appeal. I mean, he was 851 in hand, so he's going to get 20 years no matter what, in all likelihood, even if he went to trial.
We don't accept confessions of inadequate assistance. It puts the lawyer in a very uncomfortable position, right?
That's why I didn't write a reply, Your Honor.
So isn't this something better reserved for, post-conviction proceeding, arguing ineffective assistance?
That was my conclusion. That's why I just wanted to leave my argument today with those two statements. I'm not arguing ineffective assistance, counsel, right now. I just wanted to kind of leave it at where it was.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, thank you.
So... are we going to hear from someone about Gill and Bostick?
Bostick.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Bostick.
I just don't have your name on Oh, I'm sorry. You're Mr. Brindley, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay,
indeed,
my
Your
mistake.
Honor.
Okay. And you represent both of them?
No, Your Honor. I represent Mr. Bostic. I believe Mr. Gill was addressed by the first presenter this morning.
Oh, Gill and Hunter. That's right. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. That's fine. Okay. So you're Bostic. Right.
May I please the court, Judge? Regarding Mr. Bostic, I want to start by discussing Mr. Bostic's objection to the Section 2D1.1B12 enhancement under the guidelines for maintaining a stash house. He presented that argument in several forms in his sentencing memorandum and then went to sentencing. And during the portion of the sentencing where Judge Kennelly was discussing the guidelines, Judge Kennelly essentially and explicitly agreed with the argument Mr. Bostic made that, in fact, this was an ex post facto problem, but that he would have to deal with it under Section 3553 because of the DiMare case. It was still good law. That was on one day, and then we had a whole bunch of witness testimony. When it came to the Section 3553 section of his analysis, he listed a whole bunch of factors that he considered, but did not mention this one. He said he was going to consider it, and then apparently forgot or did not address it. This was not an issue where it was a matter that the court didn't find meritorious, so he could just look over it in silence. He did find it meritorious explicitly, which is an uncommon set of facts, I think, for this to happen this way. But because he didn't address it after having said that he would, and I think it's helpful to look at what happened in the Gill case on the same issue, because in Gill, he had said, I'm going to address it under 3553, and then he did explicitly, and when he did, he said, I'm going to effectively look at a guideline range two levels different. And in Mr. Bostic's case, that certainly could matter because what he said is I'm giving him the middle of the guideline range. But if he was looking at the effective range, he gave him a higher range. It would have been lower if he was looking at the one that he would have gotten if he would have addressed the argument as he said he would. And so I think a remand and resentencing is appropriate so he can address that. If there's some reason that it would be something different, I think he would have to tell us. But he said he was going to do it, and he just didn't.
So if I understand, he couldn't reinstate that higher guideline, right?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Judge.
Well, the judge isn't permitted to use a guideline that would violate the ex post facto clause, right?
Right, and now that the Pew case has come down,
so
yes.
So he'd have to calculate a different guideline. He could still give a very high sentence within the statutory maximum.
He
but
could.
You're saying he should recognize, he has to calculate the correct guideline, and you're saying he didn't do that because he didn't return to this issue. Is that?
I'm saying he had originally said that under Section 3553 he would basically give him a reduction because there's an ex post facto problem. This was pre-Pew. And then he just didn't address that. He forgot or whatever happened. He didn't do what he said he would do. And that would have made two levels difference in the guideline. And it should be remanded for resentencing on that basis. Now that Pew is law, his agreement
he
with...
He has to give the law.
He has to give
to
the lower guideline.
Impose, yeah.
And he may then say, I want to give a sentence above that. Right. But and give a justification, but we need to see that. That's why we need a remand for resentencing.
Okay.
The related issue on the issue of the sentencing had to do with the acts of violence. And what happened there, Judge Kennelly explicitly said he was not going to find Mr. Bostic was responsible for this or that shooting. There were a bunch that were alleged, and he said he wasn't going to find they were responsible for Mr. Bostic was responsible for any one. But he said, I think I can find that he was responsible for some violence. It was a very generalized statement. And I think in order for us to determine the reasonableness of the sentence, we would have to know which acts of violence he's talking about. And he just didn't identify them. He said he wasn't going to. And that's particularly problematic in this case because one of the government's witnesses that testified at the sentencing hearing was Aaron Bagley. And Aaron Bagley made explicit statements saying Mr. Bostic was not violent and that he suggested they shouldn't be violent. And when giving his analysis under Section 3553 and imposing sentence, Judge Kennelly didn't comment on Mr. Bagley. He didn't find, I find Bagley incredible and I find the other witnesses more credible. He just didn't say. And that combined with the lack of specific acts of violence makes it impossible for us to really address the reasonableness of the sentence, and it should be remanded for resentencing on that basis, too. The last issue for Mr. Bostic was the issue of the entry of his guilty plea. And at the time of his guilty plea, Mr. Bostic was not advised that any pretrial rulings that had been made, he would be unable to appeal them. And this court has said that it's certainly not common sense for defendants to know that. I think it's the Adegan case where this court has said that's not common sense for defendants to know. And he wasn't told that. And on top of not being told that, Mr. Bostic had been through, shortly before that, a motion to continue before the trial, having to do with his ability to read and some jail calls. It was fairly extensive. And the judge had denied that. And during that, counsel for Mr. Bostic expressed concerns in light of Mr. Bostic's limited reading ability to be having prepared to give testimony in his own defense in that trial. And in light of having heard that, I think it's very, very likely that that could have impacted Mr. Bostic's decision, and he could believe that he might be able to address that on appeal if he wanted to. He could have believed that. Moreover, as opposed to some of the other cases that we talked about in the briefing, this was not an instance where the court made an inquiry, knowing that had just happened, and says, are you being impacted by this decision to continue, this motion that we just, is that impacting your decision to plead guilty a few days later? That question was also not asked. And in light of that, I think that the plea cannot be proven to be knowingly entered, because he wasn't told about that he couldn't appeal any pretrial rulings, and he wasn't asked to make an explicit statement about whether or not what had just happened.
But since there hadn't been a trial, what else could he appeal besides pretrial rulings?
Well, after he's told
he can appeal, and the only rulings that he could challenge are pretrial, what's the problem?
If he wasn't told that, I'm sorry. Are you saying if he was, counterfactually?
No. He's told he can appeal, right?
He's told he can appeal he's told he can appeal, yes.
He can appeal. If he decides he wants to appeal, it would be challenging pretrial rulings, wouldn't it? Because there's no trial.
He could not challenge pretrial rulings, Judge. Once he's pled guilty, everything that's happened pretrial.
No, I understand. But when he's deciding what to do, he knows that if he decided to appeal, the only thing he could appeal would be pretrial rulings, wouldn't it? Maybe we're not communicating.
I don't know what was in his mind.
What was the choice facing him?
He was either going to have to go to trial in order to preserve his ability to appeal any pretrial rulings. The only thing he was going to be able to appeal was the sentencing. And pursuant to the plea.
If he's guilty, he could just appeal the sentence.
Right.
Okay, so
whatever happens after the guilty plea. And he wasn't advised that anything that happened before, he wasn't going to be able to appeal. And he wasn't asked to address the motion to continue, where serious concerns about the ability to be prepared were explicitly stated in very clear terms on the record. And because of that, I think it's...
Well, are you saying that he didn't realize that if he pleaded guilty, his only challenge could be to the sentencing?
Yes, Judge. I don't think that was made clear to him at all at the time of the plea colloquy.
I guess what confuses me is... So you wanted the judge to tell him... if you go to trial and lose an appeal, you could challenge pretrial rulings,
yes,
as well as rulings that...
Like in the Fisher case that was cited in the briefing, that's what happened. The defendant was told that.
But I don't understand. Well, if you say to a defendant, if you go to trial and lose, you can appeal, what more do you have to say? Why do you have to say you can appeal pretrial? What would that mean to the defendant?
I think any defendant who's just going in and you tell him he can appeal thinks he can appeal everything. And I think that's what this court said in the Adegan case.
Well,
it is not common sense.
He can appeal everything if he decides not to plead guilty.
Right, but the fact that if he's pled guilty, that means that he still can't appeal everything that happened before his guilty plea when he's told that he can appeal, I don't think that's common sense to anyone.
Well, wait a second. He's told he can appeal what?
At the time of his guilty plea, there was nothing made clear about exactly what he could appeal. That's the problem.
Well, I don't understand. Didn't the judge tell him that if you don't plead guilty, but instead you go to trial, you can appeal your conviction, you know, your sentence. But if you plead guilty, then you could then you can only appeal your sentence, didn't
he? Didn't tell him that. That's the problem.
Well, what did he tell him? Because when you go through a guilty plea, they recite a lot of things. You would have the right to go to trial. You write this, that, and the other thing that you're giving up.
What he told him was he would have a right to a jury trial, and he would have a right to confront the witnesses, and all of those things associated with a jury trial, he told him. But he did. What he did not tell him was that if you plead guilty, you will not have a right to appeal anything that happened before that guilty plea. That is never suggested, never indicated anywhere in the colloquy.
Well, what decisions were made before the guilty plea?
Certainly the issues related to his motion to continue, which I think was prevalent in his mind based on the content of that motion.
Yeah, but there weren't motions to suppress and other things.
There were not motions to suppress.
There's no decision.
There was not a ruling on it
that normally one would reserve for appeal.
There was not a substantive ruling of that sort. No, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. But was this a conditional plea reserving these rights?
No, it was not, and that's the problem.
Well, then it's waived, isn't it?
It's waived.
The argument you're making now is waived because you didn't take this conditional plea, reserving the right to appeal those issues.
No, it wouldn't be a waiver issue because what we're challenging is whether the plea itself was knowing and voluntary to begin with, and you're not going to be able to waive that challenge. You can always make that challenge.
What exactly did the judge say about appeals?
In terms of the rule, when he went through the colloquy with the defendant, all he told him was that he would be permitted to appeal. And he didn't tell him what he would be permitted to appeal. He left it vague. That's why it's a problem, Judge. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brindley. Ms. Church?
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Megan Church, and I represent the United States. I want to give Your Honors first a little bit of an overview of this organization that each of the defendants was a member of. Dana Bostic controlled a drug trafficking territory, not just a street corner, on the west side of Chicago. And the evidence developed during the course of the investigation and proved up during the sentencing hearings established that he controlled this lucrative heroin territory for nearly a decade. He was at the top. Mr. Adams was a street-level dealer in that organization. Every day from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m.
Yeah, but look, there's this, I don't know exactly what it is, number 6 of something in 1B13 that seems to be just talking about, you know, Mr. Adams, even though his initial is P in this, right? A street-level drug dealer who knows about the street-level drug dealers, same type of drug, common source of supply, but otherwise operate independently. And P is not accountable for the quantities of drugs sold by the other street-level drug dealers because he's not engaged in a jointly undertaken criminal activity with them. He's just a middleman. And then in contrast, defendant Q, another street-level drug dealer, pools his resources and profits with 4 other street-level drug dealers, and he is a conspirator with them, but isn't Adams P rather than Q?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Mr. Adams was an individual who was working alongside other workers in the Bostic organization.
No, but that's P in this comment.
He was not merely receiving a supply of heroin from a common supplier. He was working, accepting the Bostic organization's heroin, like those other workers.
Oh, wait a second. That doesn't matter. That's sharing a common source of supply.
They pooled their resources as it passed
what
up the chain.
What does that mean, pool their resources?
The proceeds. All the money that they collected from selling the Bostic organization's heroin went back up the supply chain to Bostic himself so he could get an additional supply of heroin to send back out into his territory. And what really matters here in terms of the analysis is that these weren't competitors selling their own.
I understand. Why isn't that just consignment selling?
Not consignment selling, Your Honor, because they were working for essentially the same store, not a franchise. They were working benefiting from the protection that the Bostic organization established in this territory. They were not allowed to work in that territory unless they were a member of the Bostic organization. That's why it was such a lucrative territory.
What does it mean to be a member of the organization?
It means that they knowingly sell the organization's heroin, work and receive direction from the organization's supervisors.
Why is that different from a McDonald's franchisee?
Because a franchisee is a separate organization.
But it takes its directions from the franchisor, and right?
It may take some direction from the franchisor.
No, it takes a lot of directions from the franchisor. The franchise imposes a lot of limitations on the franchisee and requires the franchisee to buy his products, the products that he sells from the franchisor and so on, or from an authorized supplier.
And that would certainly be the case for Mr. Adams if he took the heroin that he received from Mr. Bagley and took and sold it in a different area. Instead,
in a different area? Look, you have Starbucks. Some of them are owned by Starbucks. Some are franchisees. In Chicago, they're within one block of each other.
Yes, Your Honor, but here the purpose of selling in the Bostic organization's territory was to benefit Mr. Adams.
How did Mr. Adams get paid?
He was paid by Mr. Bagley after turning in the proceeds from selling.
So what you're saying, he sells so much in his allotted time, whatever proceeds he gets from that, he turns over to Bagley?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you say the other sellers would do the same thing?
Yes, Your Honor.
So after Bagley gets money, is this on a daily basis or?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, from everybody?
Yes.
Okay, how does Adams get his cut?
Mr. Bagley pays him his cut after he turns in the proceeds.
How does he determine his cut?
Mr. Bagley kept track of the amount of heroin that he passed out to each of the sellers in the territory. So when Mr. Adams turned in the proceeds, he knew, for example, that he had received 4 jabs of heroin. As a result, Mr. Adams would receive $20 per jab back to himself as his
salary. What does that have to do with his conspiring with the other sellers?
Judge, it was the agreement that they were working together. They were agreeing to sell this organization.
How does he work together with another seller for Bostic?
They alert each other to the presence of law enforcement. They work for the same supervisor. They receive the protections of the organization for selling that organization's drugs in that territory. They weren't competing against other gangs or other rivals.
They had their own territory within that, remember, sub-territories?
No, Your Honor. The whole territory was Bostic's, and these workers worked for the Bostic organization.
That's not his question. Do they have their own terror sales territory?
No, Your Honor. They
compete with each other? I don't understand.
No, Your Honor. They were there to serve the organization's customers.
Well, how does Adams determine who his customers are? I don't understand.
The way this organization worked is customers came into the area. They drove in, they walked up, they took the train. They expected to be served heroin because this organization had been established for such a long period of time. What the evidence demonstrated is on a regular basis, customers would come in, street workers like Mr. Adams would pass them the organization's heroin in exchange for blows.
That's very vague, street workers like Mr. Adams. So they come in and they buy from Adams? Why do they buy from Adams rather than one or the other?
It wasn't specific to Mr. Adams. He was simply one of the street workers who was available at that time with the organization's heroin. They could have gone to other members who were charged in this organization, for example, Parrish Mr.
Why is that different from having multiple franchisees close to each other?
Because, Your Honor, there was no competition among these workers. They were able to supply a steady stream of customers.
Boss, now you say they alert each other to law enforcement. What is that in the record?
It's contained within the record in terms of how the organization operated. With regard to Mr. Adams, it was not an issue addressed specifically at a sentencing hearing.
Well, that's very important.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do we know he alerts? How do we know he cooperates? How do we know he cooperates with the other people on his block?
For one thing, Your Honor, he continued to work for the organization. If for some reason, and this is common sense.
For the organization, but you could use this same language about a franchisee. You know, He's part of Starbucks, or he's part of McDonald's, right? That's his organization, huh?
But, Your Honor, Dana Bostic didn't have other franchises. He had one store, one open-air drug market, and the workers in that open-air drug market all worked for him. The defendant knew he was selling in Bird's territory, as Dana Bostic.
Like you go into a restaurant, I mean, just trying to figure out, the waitresses or waiters have territories that they cover.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that how this worked?
The Dana Bostic's workers, street-level workers, the street-level dealers, operated throughout the territory. There were various spots in the territory that they moved back and forth during their shifts.
Well, what Judge Kaney is pointing out is if it's that's their territory, that's in the analogy, their restaurant.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the people working within it are like servers or whatever they call them nowadays. In that, they get paid. They also get tips. Focusing on that, that's why I ask how if one gets paid, because in a franchise, if somebody has a franchise, they may pay a franchise fee. They owe something to the maid. But it's got to be a profit center in and of itself. And it seems, though, that Adams does have a commission arrangement of some kind.
Your Honor, like all the other workers in this organization, he received his commission, his
salary.
Based
on what he sold.
What he sold.
So when they pool everything to Bagley, I guess, once the money, whatever share or something, it's determined, whatever he gets back is based on his sales.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you go back to the bar or restaurant thing, where maybe the bartenders will get tips, but they pool them and then divide it up. Is that the way it happened?
No, Your Honor, it was a well-established, it wasn't exactly pooling tips.
Okay.
It was every street dealer in that territory had received the salary, the commission, for selling each jab of heroin. It was $20 per jab.
He just gets paid for what he sells. There's no pooling.
The pooling of the resources occurs at the higher level. The supervisor to each.
There's no pooling. Higher level. He just gets commissions on what he sells, period. He doesn't get any part of what some other person sells, right?
He does not get the salary or commission of what anyone else sells. There's no bonus to any of
the just like a franchisee. A franchisee doesn't get money that another franchisee earns from selling. He just gets a cut of his own sales.
A franchisee gets a cut of his own sales, but the franchisee is not working at the head organization. And here there was only the head organization.
Verbiage, right? If the difference between being an employee of Starbucks and a store owned by Starbucks and being a Starbucks franchisee is very slight, because in both cases they're paid for what they do. So I don't get what the difference is. I guess the difference would be that in a for Starbucks stores that are owned by Starbucks, maybe everybody gets a salary regardless of the actual sales of his store. But that's not Adam's situation. He just gets a cut of what he sells, which is just like a franchisee.
Or it's just like a salesman working in a clothing store who receives his salary and commission for the amount of shirts he sells. They're all working for the same store. They're all employees to the same extent.
But it would be very odd to say that salesman who's paid a commission basis, though they're rarely paid just a commission, is conspiring with the other salesman?
They're working for the common goal of making money for that store. And here
they're making money for themselves.
They're making money for themselves, but here what these workers did, similar to an individual who's working in the store or a waiter or waitress working for the same restaurant, is their sales directly benefit the organization, and by working for that organization, they receive the protection, the benefit.
Defendant Q in the sentencing guideline comment pools his resources and profits with four other street-level drug dealers. And Adams is not pooling his resources and profits with the other dealers. Now, if in fact he is warning them about the police, okay, that begins to help your position, but you say that's not in the record. So. Well,
Judge, with respect to what's in the record, the criminal complaint that was included in as part of the record in this case, and is the first docket entry, refers to how members of this organization alerted each other to the presence of law enforcement. There is no specific instance in which Mr. Adams alerts other members of the organization to law enforcement, but that was a common occurrence in this organization, one of the ways that they were able to benefit each other and the organization's heroin sales. So with respect to Mr. Adams, it was not specifically addressed, but this is how the organization worked and why it was so successful in selling heroin in this territory.
How many blocks was this? What was the area?
It was Congress to Karlov, Pulaski to Van Buren. And what was so unique about this area is it's right by the Blue Line L station. It's right off the Eisenhower Expressway, and there are lots of other streets that are busy. And so the evidence established that the customers knowingly drove into or walked into the area, were able to get their fix of heroin, and go back out. And because it was such a steady, relatively safe area due to the organization's control, they knew they could get the heroin. And the street sellers in that territory knew that they would be able to have a steady supply of customers for this organization.
They weren't bothered by other criminals. They were only concerned about the police, maybe.
Yes, Your Honor. And with respect to the arguments raised by Mr. Bostick, during prior to what was going to be the trial date, he filed an emergency motion to continue the trial based on counsel's unsupported allegations that it appeared to him that Bostick was illiterate. The district court engaged in a lengthy colloquy with defense counsel.
What did the judge say precisely about his right of appeal?
Your Honor, I don't have the record citation right in front of me, but in Mr. Bostick's own written plea declaration, which counsel represented to the court that he had gone over line by line with Mr. Bostick, that he was waiving all appellate issues that might otherwise have been available had he exercised his right to trial. And this is at record site 784 at pages 24 to 28. So this was something that, based on counsel's representations and is contained in the plea declaration, he had been advised of the appellate issues and knew that he was waiving all those issues that he might otherwise have been available. And the only issue that was raised with regard to this issue was the denial of his emergency motion to continue the trial date. The judge clearly did not abuse his discretion there. Mm-hmm. If there are further questions from the court.
Well, the Gill and Hibner included in that? Or Hibner? Are you agreeing? Do you agree with the position that the defendants have taken on this?
Not exactly, Your Honor. We believe that a limited remand is appropriate for Mr. Gill in light of Pugh because the district court did take into consideration the ex post facto result of applying the stash house enhancement.
Reducing his offense level to 38?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're not sending it back for resent? Well, right. You're sending it back for the judge to say whether he wants to resent.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. And with regard to Mr. Bostick on the similar issue, Mr. Bostick was very careful to raise only the issue on appeal as to whether or not the district court procedurally erred in failing to address the ex post facto argument again under 3553A. Nowhere in defense counsel's arguments to the district court after the district court already said he would consider it did he raise it again. The district court, as the record is borne out, went through in detail every single argument that the defendant raised under 3553A. There was no reason for him to comment further on what he already said he would consider.
Were these defendants all charged in the same indictment?
Yes, Your Honor.
What did he say about the stash house?
With regard to the stash house, Judge Kennelly found that the stash house enhancement applied to the defendant, but he recognized the fact that there were ex post facto concerns and that he would consider it under 3553A. The defendant didn't argue it again under 3553A, but the judge had already said he would consider it. And for those reasons, there was no procedural error.
And what about, you want to say anything about Hunter?
Your Honor, we agree that Mr. Hunter waived any challenge. However, as the record is also borne out, that even if Your Honors were to consider the denial of his motion to suppress, the district court did not clearly err in its assessment.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And is there anything further from the defendant's counsel?
Your Honor, if I could have a minute.
Sure, Mr. Bradley. Yeah.
With respect to the question of the stash house enhancement in Section 3553, the problem with it is it happened on two different days. When he talked about the guidelines, he said he was going to consider it. And then when he talked about Section 3553, he did not say anything. He didn't consider it at all. And then he didn't treat it. He said originally he was going to treat it like he did in Gill. But then when he did the Section 3553, he didn't do that. And that is procedurally, that is deficient and should be remanded for resentencing on that basis, as well as the issues about the violence that I raised earlier. Regarding the guilty plea, it's our position that in the Rule 11 context, the judge needs to advise him, and he didn't give him any kind of advice that would indicate that he wasn't going to be able to appeal any issue that might be related to that motion to continue, which, regardless how meritorious it might have been, that it may have been in the defendant's mind and would render it unknowing. With that, I thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Brindley. Anything further from Mr. Sachs or Mr. Schiller? I think not. Okay, well, thank you.